Good morning. If there are any of you here who have not been tempted, you can just you don't have to pay attention. If you're like the rest of us, temptation is not a daily event, not an hourly event. It's more like an every minute event. When we think of temptation, I mean, Jerry read from Psalms 119. We often think of things like covetousness, lust, lying, envy. I remember the story of these pastors who got marooned on an island and waiting for to be rescued, and they got really talking to each other. And when they start talking about their temptations, one says, "You know, I'm really tempted by laziness. I get all my sermons off the internet." Another said, "Well, I'm tempted by the money. You know, I just take a little bit from every offering that goes by." And the other says, "Well, my temptation is gossip, and I can't wait till we get rescued." So we all deal with temptation. And one of the hope we have is from Hebrews, where it says about Jesus that he's tempted as we were. Hebrews 4:14, "For we do not have a high priest who is unable to sympathize with our weaknesses, but one who in every respect has been tempted as we are, yet without sin." That gives us a sense of hope. He knows what we're going through. We're not alone when we're tempted. But where do we see Jesus tempted? Well, we've got his temptation in the desert. He's out there for 40 days, and it's recorded in Matthew 4. And I'm going to read this, and then we'll spend some time talking about this passage. I'm reading from Matthew 4:1-11. "Then Jesus was led up by the Spirit into the wilderness to be tempted by the devil. And after fasting 40 days and 40 nights, he was hungry. And the tempter came and said to him, 'If you are the Son of God, command these stones to become loaves of bread.' But he answered, 'It is written, man shall not live by bread alone, but by every word that comes from the mouth of God.' Then the devil took him to the holy city and set him on the pinnacle of the temple and said to him, 'If you are the Son of God, throw yourself down, for it is written, he will command his angels concerning you, and on their hands they will bear you up, lest you strike your foot against a stone.' Jesus said to him, 'Again it is written, you shall not put the Lord your God to the test.' Again, the devil took him to a very high mountain and showed him all the kingdoms of the world and their glory. And he said to him, 'All these I will give you if you fall down and worship me.' Then Jesus said to him, 'Begone, Satan, for it is written, you shall worship the Lord your God, and him only shall you serve.' Then the devil left him, and behold, angels came and were ministering to him." I have puzzled over this passage for a long time. Because to be honest, I look at these temptations and I think, I never got tempted to jump off of a tower. I never got tempted to turn stone into bread. Probably I've been tempted to idolize. And so I've always just questioned and thought, why these temptations? These just don't make any sense to me. And so this passage left me with two questions. Why was Jesus tempted with these temptations? What's the significance of these temptations? And second, are they really the kind of temptations that I face? And so I'm going to answer these because earlier this year I spent some time. I read this passage as I read through the Bible every year. I was reading it, and I just started thinking and praying and journaling, and I got some ideas that I'd like to share with you. Let's start further back, though. To answer why these temptations, we need to understand who was Jesus, why did he come? And to answer that, we need to know who were the people of Israel. Because he's quoting all these verses from Deuteronomy, which is a book of the law that was given to the people of Israel. Now, if you know your Old Testament history, the people of Israel were to be a people devoted to God. They were to be his representatives on earth who would point everybody to the true God. They were be a kingdom of priests. And they had the law. best codified, the Ten Commandments. But they also had all the sacrificial law. They had all the regulations that talked about how rebellious, fallen human beings could approach God and have a relationship with Him through this sacrificial system. We read in Deuteronomy 26, I'm going to read 16 through 19. Writer says, "Today the Lord your God is commanding you to keep these statutes and ordinances, something you must do with all your heart and soul. Today you have declared the Lord to be your God, and that you will walk in His ways, keep His statutes, commandments, and ordinances, and obey Him. And today the Lord has declared you to be His special people, as He already promised you, so you may keep all His commandments. Then He will elevate you above all the nations He has made, and you will receive praise, fame, and honor. You will be a people holy to the Lord, your God, as He has said." The people of Israel were to be a holy people. They were to represent to the world around them the character and nature of God, His holiness. They didn't do a very good job. Their history showed they were completely inadequate for the task right from the start. So, you know, he deals with Abraham, and eventually they move to Egypt, and then all the law comes when God's taking them out of Egypt into the promised land. That's when they get the law. That's when God's taking them to the promised land. What did they do? They weren't out of Egypt very long, and they started complaining about their food. Now, if you have kids, you just assume kids are going to complain about food. We've got two grandsons, and they will have a favorite food one week, and the next week they don't like it anymore. And our grandson Sam said, "I don't eat bread, but I eat baguettes." When I was his age, I didn't know what a baguette was. And so they started complaining about the food. Exodus chapter 16, verse 2. "The whole congregation of the people of Israel grumbled against Moses and Aaron in the wilderness. And the people of Israel said to them, 'Would that we had died by the hand of the Lord in the land of Egypt, when we sat by the meat pots and ate bread to the full. For you have brought us into this wilderness to kill this whole assembly with hunger.'" So, the people who are representing God complain about what they're eating and complain and accuse Moses and God of taking them into the wilderness to kill them. Not only do they complain about the food, they tested God. That is, they tried His patience, not believing that He would faithfully take care of them. So in Exodus 17, verses 1a to 2, "There was no water for the people to drink. Therefore the people quarreled with Moses and said, 'Give us water to drink.' And Moses said to them, 'Why do you quarrel with me? Why do you test the Lord? Why are you trying the Lord's patience?'" So they messed up. They did, when they got thirsty, they turned on Moses and they turned on God. The people who are to represent God now are complaining to Him. Again, saying, "You're not taking care of us." And then finally, the worst, they worship the golden calf. Remember, Moses goes up the mountain and is gone for a long time. And the people get impatient. So Exodus 32, 1 to 6. "When the people saw that Moses delayed to come down from the mountain, the people gathered themselves together to Aaron and said to him, 'Up, get up. Make us gods who shall go before us. As for this Moses, the man who brought us up out of the land of Egypt, we do not know what has become of him.' So Aaron said to them, 'Take off the rings of gold that are in the ears of your wives, your sons, your daughters, and bring them to me.'" As an aside, I suppose that's a biblical warrant for body piercing for men. Just a joke. So all the people took off the rings of gold that were in their ears and brought them to Aaron. And he received the gold from their hand and fashioned it with a graving tool and made a golden calf. And they said, "These are your gods, O Israel, who brought you up out of the land of Egypt." When Aaron saw this, he built an altar before it. And Aaron made a proclamation and said, "Tomorrow shall be a feast to the Lord." And they rose up early the next day and offered burnt offerings and brought peace offerings. And the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play. Well, Moses hears about this, comes down, grinds that idol up, makes them drink it, throws it in the water. This is outright idolatry. Now, interestingly, they had an image. They didn't say this image was a different god. This image was still to be the god that Moses served, but they had an image of him which had been expressly prohibited in the Ten Commandments. And so they wanted to worship God the way they wanted to rather than acknowledging how he wanted them to worship. And so because of their idolatry, God has them remain wandering in the desert for 40 years before entering the Promised Land. So notice, they got hungry, they tested God, they worshipped an idol. You starting to see the connection? The Israelites were to be the holy people representing God, and yet when they were tempted, they failed every time. Jesus goes into the wilderness for 40 days. He has the same temptations they did. He got hungry, and the tempter challenged him to turn stone into bread, but he refused, quoting from Deuteronomy 8:3. He was tempted to test God's faithfulness by jumping off the highest point of the temple, but he refused, again quoting from Deuteronomy 6:16. He was tempted to worship Satan, but he refused, quoting from Deuteronomy 6:13. So he was in the wilderness for 40 days, not 40 years, but he was tempted the way the people of Israel were tempted, but he did not yield. He lived a perfect life. So the people of Israel were to represent God to other humans, but they failed. So God sent His Son to live the life the people of Israel were supposed to live. He did it perfectly. And we know all the sacrificial laws and practices of the Israels were a picture of what Jesus was going to do. And so we see Jesus lived, and one, he went down as a baby to Egypt and came back out of Egypt. His life paralleled the life of the people of Israel, but without sin. And so he has become our representative of God, and because he is in fact God. So why these temptations? Because they confirmed that Jesus was the Messiah. These were the temptations of the people, and it was a confirmation that he was fulfilling all those prophecies about the coming Messiah who would be the Redeemer of the people of Israel. He had the same temptations they did in the wilderness, but he did not fail. He did not yield to the temptations. So that is why those temptations, because they confirmed who Jesus was. And they make it clear to us that Jesus was God and part of God's plan from the beginning. His life paralleled the life of the people of Israel, but done in a way that continued to honor God. With no sin. But then that second question, are these our temptations? So we're going to go back through these and look at these and start asking, are these our temptations? The Spirit leads Jesus into the wilderness to be tempted. So the temptations are part of the plan. And he doesn't eat anything for 40 days. I'm going to bet there's nobody here who has fasted for 40 days. I'll bet some of you have never fasted more than a day, and some of maybe not. This is not an argument for fasting, but 40 days without food, you would be very hungry. And that's when the temptation comes. Now, you know, I don't think the temptation here is to eat, though. You know, I'm often tempted to eat what I shouldn't eat. We had a really nice meal last night, and then we went and had some ice cream at Cold Stone Creamery. Their perfect peanut butter chocolate cup. But I've repented. I've confessed. All the sugar that I didn't eat the last month, I got at one time. And it really tasted good. And I was very thankful to God that people make that. But I don't think it's eating is the issue here, or what he's eating. But Jesus is hungry, so the tempter recommends that Jesus turn some stones into bread. What is the temptation here? Why would you be tempted to turn a stone into bread? He had a need. He was hungry. He was God. He had power. But he would be used, if he turned that stone into bread, he would be using his power to meet his need in a way not authorized by God. Magicians would turn stone into bread. If you know something of the history of philosophy and science, there was a period of time when there was a branch of study called alchemy, where they were trying to turn lead into gold. They were trying to turn worthless substances into something of value. And that was some of the early practitioners of science, of what we call science now. But God created stone to be stone. To change stone into something else is to violate, exploit God's creation for your own purposes. God created that stone to be a stone. Now, we know that Jesus took bread, broke it, and it kept multiplying and fed the 4,000, then the 5,000. That was a miracle, but that was a miracle that paralleled how God does things. It didn't violate God's world. How do you get bread? You plant wheat seeds. They grow. You grind it up. You make bread. But some of those seeds you keep and you replant. So wheat seed, bread comes from wheat. And so to break bread is the same process of multiplication that happens in the grain that God created. God's not doing, Christ, when he broke the bread and multiplied the bread and fishes, again, the fish multiply, it's a natural process, wasn't doing anything that violated how God runs the world, how God created the world. But when Satan said, turn the stone into bread, what he's saying, your need is so important, you just exploit God's world for your purposes and ignore God's purposes. So, to turn that stone into bread is to say to God, God, I have an overwhelming need for food, and I can't trust you to meet that need. I can't trust you, so I'm going to take care of it myself without asking your help. I refuse to be dependent on you. I'll do it myself. I don't know about you. Well, that's a temptation I struggle with all the time. I have needs. Am I going to take the initiative and meet these needs in ways that are dishonoring to God? It can be all sorts of areas. It can be areas of appetite, as we see it here, but it can be in other areas. Am I going to trust God to meet my needs, or am I going to exploit His world and ignore His care for me and take charge myself? That's a temptation we all deal with. It's a refusal to be dependent on God and His meeting of our needs. We see where in the New Testament where Paul says, I've learned to be content with little, with much. That's the attitude of somebody who is dependent on God meeting his needs. I am content with what God gives me. I'm not going to say, I want this, so I'm going to go get it myself because God's not giving it to me. I've heard Christians get mad at God because He didn't give them the money they needed to support the house that they built that was bigger than they could afford. Those are the kinds of temptations we have. I need this, so I'm going to make it happen, rather than waiting in dependence on God. Now, this doesn't mean being dependent on God. Like I had a friend once, he said, I want to be so filled with the Holy Spirit, I never have to make a decision. Well, that's just, God doesn't treat us as puppets. We need to be wise, discerning. We need to make plans, but at the same time, we need to hold our plans loosely and be guided by God. We need prudence. We need wisdom. A lot of people, just to use the house, buy more house than they can afford, which puts them in financial trouble. That's not being dependent on God and accepting where God has placed you. But I've known people who bought a little house, less than they could afford, were able to save money and eventually have a bigger house. And they said, because we feel like God's taught us this, and now we can use this house for His purposes. God meets our needs, but we are cooperating with Him. It's not we just put our, turn our minds off and let God guide us. But at the same time, we have to recognize and live each moment understanding our dependence on God. That we don't take the initiative without first asking God, what do you want here? I'm tempted that way. I've never been tempted to turn a stone into rock. Into bread. I would have no idea how to do that. Though I have chewed on some sand at some point, but not intentionally. It's not very good. But I've been tempted many times to take charge of my life and say, God, I don't need you. I'm not going to be dependent on you. It's my need. It's overwhelming. I can't trust you. Not trusting God is a temptation we all have. Now, Jesus answers this, man does not live by bread alone, but by every word that comes from the mouth of God. We do live in a physical world. We have physical bodies. They need substance. They need bread from the physical world. Theoretical bread doesn't fill your stomach. But Jesus makes the point that in this physical world, our true food comes from God. So, anything we do to take charge of our own needs and not look first to God for how to meet these needs is to live cut off from our true source of sustenance. Jesus is the bread of life, and He will give us bread in His time and His way. When we are all tempted to take control of our lives and needs and live as if we're not dependent on God and every word that comes from His mouth. I read an interesting book by a Christian philosopher, and he talked about how many Christians live as practical atheists. They go to church, they say all the right things, but they live their lives as if God is not involved and not responsible for what's in their lives. They live as practical atheists. They live without considering how they are dependent on God in their daily life. Now, the second tempter, now identified as the devil, takes Jesus to a high point of the temple and challenges Him to throw Himself down, reminding Him that God's angels will lift Him up, not let His foot strike against the stone. I mean, just think about this. Think if you had somebody film this and it was on YouTube. I guarantee if you threw yourself off of a temple, let's say a Space Needle in Seattle, any high place, and angels come and grab you, that video is going to go viral. And you could make a lot of money selling books, seminars on how to do this. But what's the temptation here? It's to test God. Try His patience. It's to say, God, I don't really think You can take care of me, so I'm going to do something drastic to see what You'll do. It's trying to push God to act before He's ready to act. Satan says, test God, see if He'll really rescue you. This is, again, a lack of trust. Now, how'd Jesus answer? He quotes from Deuteronomy 6:16, "You are not to put the Lord your God to the test." You know, it's again refusing to acknowledge we're dependent on God. And the people, when they lacked water, they started to complain. They wanted Moses to do something now. You know, we have this temptation too, to demand that God take care of us, to distrust His faithfulness to us, to take care of ourselves on our own timeline. We can try His patience. I talked to somebody, a Christian guy, who said to me, "I did everything that God commanded about money, and I had to declare bankruptcy, even though I tithed and I did everything God said. God let me down." Now, that is not a trusting attitude. That's an attitude that would test God's patience, because it's refusing to acknowledge that God's the one in charge, and it's not me who's going to force God's hand. One way we can look at the disciple Judas, who betrayed Jesus, was he was trying to force Jesus' hand. He wanted to know, are you really the Messiah? And one way to do that is to create a crisis. What he didn't know is that played into God's plan for a suffering servant. He was expecting it to be the king, the political redeemer of Israel. But again, he was testing God. He was not trusting that God will be faithful. I have that temptation. You know, there are times where I think, okay, God, hurry up, hurry up, hurry up. Get it done. And we want God to work on our timetable. It doesn't work that way. The final temptation. The devil takes him to a high mountain and shows him the grandeur of the world God has created. I want to know what mountain that is where you can see the whole world. But, you know, this is really a very interesting view. You know, you could get up high. I don't know if you've ever been anywhere up high in the mountains. You know, I've known people who've always been in Florida, so mountains are kind of scary to them. But you get up high, I mean, the world looks amazing. It's not like if you fly in an airplane over them, they all look flat because you're looking down like this. You get on top of a mountain. I remember once when I lived in Knoxville one winter, I was hiking in the Smoky Mountains. And that night there was an ice storm, and everything got coated with ice. We were in a tent that was getting ripped apart by the wind and the ice, so we found an abandoned cabin, a ranger cabin. We actually broke into it. They had plywood against the window, and we broke in just because it was a safety issue. And there was a tower, and that morning we climbed that tower and had a quarter inch of ice everywhere. So we were very careful, and it was probably 50, 60 feet up. And we looked out, and you could see the highest peak of the Appalachians sticking out of the clouds. Everything else was below the clouds. That's just one of those views that I just remember. It was absolutely gorgeous. We stayed up there so long, the ice started to melt off. So it was a lot easier to go down. But just to see those peaks, there were five or six of them up above the clouds. So Satan takes Jesus up and says, "Look at all this. If you worship me, I'll give it to you. I'll give all of it to you." Now, this is just a direct and blatant encouragement to worship something or someone other than God. Because look how Jesus responds. "You are to worship the Lord your God and serve only Him." He actually slips in that "only." It's not in the Deuteronomy. But we're only to worship God the Father. How do we struggle with this temptation? Now, I've never had Satan take me to the top of a mountain and say, "Look at all this." But, you know, we all orient ourselves to something outside ourselves. We're always looking for something that we want to worship. We may not put it in those terms, but if you've ever thought, "If only I did X, then I'd feel okay," that's a kind of idolatrous relationship. "If only I had this, then I'd be okay." All of that, we orient ourselves towards something else. We define ourselves not in terms of ourselves, but in terms of something outside ourselves. When I was in college, there was a while I raced bicycles because it was fun. But, you know, I realized for these people, this is their world. They define themselves in terms of that one activity. I'm a bicycle racer, and it gave them status above other people. They look down on other people, and that's one reason I quit. The other was they are all faster than I was, so I wasn't any good. I liked the training rides where you just ride around South Florida and look at the scenery. They wanted to race and win, and it was not that important to me if I won or not. But we always orient ourselves and find something that gives our life meaning or gives us identity. I mean, if you look at our world, if you watch TV, you see lots of things appealing to give you purpose and identity. Look at how people treat professional sports. It becomes a religion to them. They have the emotions. It's something, these things appeal to us emotionally. They evoke a wide range of emotions. Anger, excitement, loyalty, pride, disappointment. We're always orienting to something outside ourselves. Those things become idols. But here's the problem. We are born as worshipers. We're wired as human beings. We only know each other by what is outside of ourselves. None of us has a stance from which we can really stand outside ourselves and look at ourselves. We need each other. That's partly why the church as the body of Christ is so important. We learn who we are in our community. But here's what happens. All of us want to worship something outside ourselves, but we also want to be able to control that. Because our hearts, as rebellious people, refuse to let God be in charge. We want to be in charge. So an idol is a way to have a God we worship that we also control. It hedges our bets. If you worship the true God, that means your life is no longer your own. And I've talked to non-believers, you know, say, you know, well, you became a Christian because you need a crutch. I said, look, if I'm wounded, yeah, I need a crutch. But I tell you, following Jesus is not like having a crutch. It's like having a coach that pushes you when you don't want to move. Following Jesus, making Him and worshiping Him means my life is not my own. And there's a cost to it. There are things that I want that I say, nope, can't have it. I can't follow Jesus and have that. There are things that I'd like to do that I say, nope, if I'm going to follow Jesus, I can't do that. If you make Jesus your Lord, your life is not your own. Amen. And so, but we all want idol worship is we want somebody that has that role in our lives, but we still control them. We don't want God to be in charge, so we're stuck. How can we have something outside us in charge of us, but at the same time we're in charge of them? That's what idol at the heart of idol worship is. And we all struggle with this. And the things that people pursue as idols, I mean, they can be pleasure. We can make pleasure our God. We can make power our God. Or money our God. Money is a tool for getting pleasure or power. I mean, those are, when you look, the number of things that people may orient to is multiple, but what they're trying to get is really not that not that wide a universe. It's some sense of pleasure, some sense of security, some sense of power. But Jesus was tempted, but He did not give in to the temptation. If He had given in, we wouldn't be here. We wouldn't be following Him. He would not have accomplished the Father's purpose. We'd still be dead in our sins. But because He was faithful against those temptations, we can rest in His righteousness. His righteousness becomes our righteousness. So He who knew no sin became sin for us, that we might have the righteousness of God. I'm tempted this way to make something an idol. I think we all are. So I hope this gives you an answer to that second question. Are these the kinds of temptations we have? And we can see that Jesus dealt with them well. And we learn one other important thing from Jesus. When you're tempted, read Deuteronomy. It worked for Jesus.